Hello, everybody. This is Marcy Heim, and welcome to our June topic call with the Major Gift Success Club. I am delighted and honored to have all of you with me today, and especially excited today. I have not one but two guests with me today to talk about our very important topic, the cost per dollar raised myth and how to talk to donors about it. Before we jump into that, let me just remind all of you that every one of our calls are recorded, and you're able to not only get these calls with the audio that I send out to you, but it's also available on my website, and you have a special code to access that. So please be sure to go back and listen to these again so you can get the very best information out of it possible. I want to congratulate and thank all of you for taking the time to invest in your own professional development. It's so vitally important. If you're not growing, my friends, you're dying. You're going down. And the way to stay fulfilled and excited and vibrant in this honorable and noble profession is to continuously enrich ourselves with new knowledge like these programs. So thank you for investing in yourself, and thank you for joining me on these calls. Today we'll be talking about the cost per dollar raised myth and how to talk about this with your donors. Let me ask you a few questions. Are you still talking to your donors about overhead and the cost of overhead and struggles with overhead? Does your board operate on the premise of aiming for low overhead? What can we do to shrink that number? Is that a focus? Do you squeeze your budget to get the lowest possible percentage of overhead? Do you even look at how you can record something to manipulate this number? Yikes! If so, stop it right now and join me today with my very special guests, twin sisters Laura and Julie Mukuska, principals at the Mukuska Group, Inc. in Winnipeg, Canada, as they share how to help your donors understand what really counts. Laura and Julie, welcome.
Thank you.
Let me give you a little bit of background about Laura and Julie. First, Laura, before founding Mukuska Group in 1998, Laura worked in the nonprofit and education sectors for 15 years, where she held leadership positions in the public service and in community organizations. Her career included aspects of management, board governance, and fund development. Her work with Mukuska Group has included working with clients in all aspects of fund development. This would include capital campaigns, annual campaigns, major gifts, donor engagement and stewardship, coaching and mentoring, fundraising audits, events, feasibility studies, board governance, communications, and key messages. Laura is a member of the AFP International and AFP Manitoba, where she has previously served on the board as communication chair and co-chair of National Philanthropy Day. And in fact, it was at a National Philanthropy Day where I had the pleasure of being with them on my birthday. I was born on National Philanthropy Day, November 15th, and it was a delightful day. And I want you all to know, if you want to see a top rate, just totally organized, elegant, excellent event, it's that chapter's Philanthropy Day. Congratulations to you on an outstanding event. She was reappointed to the board of AFP Canadian Council for the 2014-2015 year. Laura enjoys golfing, and she makes excellent wine. She also loves the Winnipeg Jets and the Goldeyes and living in the best city in Canada. Now, Laura's sister Julie has worked in nonprofits and the charitable sector since 1984 in the areas of advocacy, education, and community organizations. Her career spans many areas of fund development and management, including alumni relations, public affairs, communications, capital campaigns, donor engagement, stewardship, and events. Since joining Mukuska Group in 2011, she's worked with clients on a variety of projects, including coaching and mentoring, recruitment and retention of development staff, you know, a topic very near and dear to me, creating a culture of engagement, feasibility studies, campaign plans, development plans, key messages and communications, policies, and board governance. Julie is also a member of AFP Manitoba and AFP International. She received the University of Manitoba Outreach Award in 1998, and she's received over 30 juried awards for publications, programs, events, and projects at the University of Manitoba related to public affairs and fundraising communications from the Canadian Council for the Advancement of Education, the CCAE, as well as the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education, or CAESE. So the version in Canada and the version here in the States. Outside of her work with McCuska Group, Julie is an advocate for mental health and the removal of stigma around mental illness. So important. She enjoys golf, also the Winnipeg Jets hockey, and heart-healthy cooking. Once again, Laura and Julie, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's launch right into this. And one thing that Laura and Julie, because they are twins, because they sound a lot alike, they've agreed to let you know which one of them is presenting so that you know who to follow up with when you have questions or just who you're hearing from. So if you would first be willing, gals, to share a little bit about how you were first inspired to get into this whole world or this whole honorable and noble profession of nonprofits.
Hi, Marcy. It's Laura. I'd love to answer that, but I just want to remind people that we did have a great event when you came up to AFP and told us ahead of time that it was your birthday, and I remember eating red velvet cupcakes with you to celebrate.
Yes, we did.
It was
red velvet cupcakes. It was wonderful.
So yes, I first got into nonprofits through a seniors organization. I had previously worked in government, and this was a new venture for me, and I just loved it. I loved how the volunteers were inspired to contribute. I loved how people wanted to support the organization and everything about it. And so it really spurred me to continue to work in the nonprofit world. And this is Julie. I also worked for the same seniors organization, but a couple of years earlier, and I had the same experience. I was quite inspired, and it also led me to take a job at the University of Manitoba, where I ended up, as you noted, I worked there for 23 years, worked on many campaigns, was inspired by the donors who supported the university, and was really moved to work in the community after joining McCuska Group and seeing all of the organizations that do their work with such passion and have been able to, with our help, learn how to do it better.
Yes. Well, as we launch into this topic today, it can be a little bit challenging for some folks, just what exactly are we talking about. So can we begin, please, by defining some terms? What is cost per dollar raised?
Hi, it's Laura. There's some very, very specific rules about cost per dollar raised that the Canada Revenue Agency and the IRS outline, and it's very specific to, depending on what activity you're doing, is it related to fundraising, and do you have to contribute, or do you have to identify that those costs are related to fundraising? So it's actually a very complex formula, but you have to be aware that those rules exist. So I'd encourage everybody to go on those two websites, the CRA and the IRS, depending on which country you're living in, and make sure that the people that are responsible for your accounting are aware of those measurements. But the other thing that we talk about is why are people so hung up on having a low cost per dollar raised? And we have a really good example. It's the Heart and Stroke Foundation in Canada. And they have a really neat explanation on their website about how they spend 59% of every dollar raised on administering that program. And you might be shocked at that number, but for them, they're saying that we raise this amount of money, and by doing that, we are able to achieve this amount, these results.
So could you repeat that, please? That's the heartandstrokefoundation.com. Is that how they would find it?
Heart and Stroke Foundation. I think it's heartandstroke.ca.
Okay. And that would be a great thing. 59%, I know, would shock some folks. Are there any other terms as we get into this conversation that you feel it's important for us to define?
I don't think so, because we really are talking about the notion of overhead, and I guess overhead in our view includes things like salaries. It includes keeping the lights on, you know, having a photocopier and contracting out services that you do, maybe your HR. So those are the things that kind of encompass overhead.
Yep, good. I think it's good to say that. Yes, indeed. All right. So what do you think is the driver behind some of our donors or executive directors working so hard to achieve low overhead? What do you think is behind that?
Well, I think it's because there's a whole notion of charity as one where you're begging for support. And it's always been a measure that, oh, we only spend, you know, 10 cents on a dollar, and we're going to try to get that down. It's just been part of the conversation for so long. And I'll give you an example of that. One of our clients, we actually say to all of our clients, please join AFP. It says you are serious about fundraising and ethical fundraising in particular. But the board would not allow the executive director to join AFP because they saw it as a cost, not an investment. Really, we should be interested in raising the whole community up. And that's the partnership between donors and the organizations that do the work. And so we should be talking about impact as opposed to overhead.
Yep, and you know, you have a wonderful quote that I read in one of your blogs. So this is again from Julie and Laura. Overhead is not an indication of impact. Low overhead is not a badge of honor. And by not educating donors about how an investment of their funds includes keeping the lights on, you are doing them a disservice. Talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. This is Julie. If you're concentrating on squeezing everything out of an organization, it's really a race to the bottom. You'll never win. The less you invest in your organization, the harder it is to do the work that you set out in your mission. Nonprofit doesn't mean to starve an organization. It means the profits are for the community's benefit and not others, as it is in the profit world. So it's really important to make sure that the organization is on sound financial footing. So if you and an organization want to do what's best for your community, that requires investment for that community impact.
And certainly then by not, I think sometimes we tend to almost, recoil. You know, we hear a donor bring up, so what's your overhead costs? And almost in an accusatory way, and we kind of crumble at that. You know, we're like, oh, no, and we somehow feel like we're not worthy of a reasonable salary or worthy of having, does this play a part of it too, our own self-assessment?
This is Julie. Yes, indeed, it does. Working in the nonprofit sector, gives people that sense that, well, maybe they don't deserve that salary, as you said. But the impact of that is that, as you've also identified, it makes it hard to retain staff and even volunteers if they see that there's not enough being invested into the community, into the organization to have that great impact. But I think, as you say, it's important to educate donors, and we need to take it upon ourselves to say, I understand that you have a question about what the organization spends. Let me take a few minutes and talk to you about the impact we have in our community. And then the conversation can go in a different direction as opposed to just those numbers on the balance sheet.
Of course. Okay. So it's to always link these costs produce these results. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. You have written, and later let's be sure to let people know how to subscribe to your blog, but you've written about a tale of two nonprofit organizations as it relates to overhead. Would you share that story with us?
Sure, I can. It's Julie again. So First Organization raises about $500,000 a year from donors, and this is unchanged in many years. They're really proud that they spend only 15 cents on the dollar, so $75,000, to fundraise. But they're on their third development director in 3 years, and they spend a lot of time acquiring new donors to replace the ones they've lost since the last year. On average, one donor is lost for every one they get. The other organization raises $10 million in donations, up from the $2 million they raised just 5 years ago. Their fundraising costs are 45 cents on the dollar, or $4.5 million. They have low turnover of fundraising staff, as they offer competitive salaries and benefits, including generous professional development grants. They also spend time acquiring new donors, but on average, they keep 20% more donors than they lose every year. So if you were talking to people who like low overhead, the first organization is clearly superior to the second. I mean, clearly they're not spending enough or much to raise their funds. But using overhead as a measurement condemns the first organization to an unending cycle of acquisition and loss, and it never allows for true engagement of donors. Pinching pennies is not the way to advance. In the case of the second organization, the leadership recognizes that you have to spend money to make money. This is not a concept that is foreign in the for-profit world. Communicating with donors takes money and people. So while they spend more, they're growing, and as a result, more overall spending is going to their cause. And because they aren't afraid to be completely transparent about what it costs, their donors come back, and their staff stay, and they grow with them.
And I also noticed you mentioned in the second organization that they invest in their staff growth. There are two things, and I know you do a lot of feasibility studies too. I like to use those opportunities when you're in front of major donors, certainly to do our feasibility work, but to also just say to them, how do you feel in general about those of us who come out and talk to you about making gifts? And I'm surprised at how many will say to me, and one comment in particular just rocked me, where she looked at me and said, I don't even bother to learn their names anymore. It'll be somebody different next time. And I think that's a real tragedy.
It definitely is. I remember at the University of Manitoba, one donor, fairly longtime donor, said at one point, I'm on my 12th development officer.
Mm.
That's just tragic.
That just makes me wince. Oh, dear. You know, I guess for me, and you and I have both been in the university setting for 23 years, coincidentally, and I had folks that I worked with that entire time. I mean, we have lifelong relationships from our work together at the university, and I can't imagine one of my donors saying I've met with 12 different people. Now, I do think that, yes, you want people to be involved with more than one person in your organization and all of that. I'm not saying we own donors or it's my donor or any of that kind of stuff. But certainly, how can you have a deep friendship if people are turning over that quickly, or a deep relationship, or understand the history of their engagement? So in your first organization, when their development team basically is there long enough to get some experience and then they move on to an organization where they can get paid better or have more resources with which to do their work, you're really setting up a situation that's tough on the donors that we're supposed to care about.
Exactly.
That's a very powerful story. And I would suggest to everybody listening here today to use those stories as you have your conversation with donors, to actually say, let me tell you a story about a couple of nonprofits and here's how things are different for them, because I think the stories really illustrate the concerns we have. So there are donors who go online. And they go to such services as GuideStar, et cetera, and they look up the cost per dollar raised. If it's above a certain amount, they just kind of say, I don't want to support that organization. So what exactly might a development officer say to these folks? Or is there a time, if they're just kind of, you know, I'm all about cost per dollar raise, to just, as we might say, bless and release. You know, we understand you feel that way. This is what our cost per dollar raised is, and we're not a fit. I mean, do you have any advice on how long you try to counteract this?
It's Laura. I'm going to answer this one. There's actually been a movement, in fact, led by GuideStar and two other organizations. And they produced a letter to the donors of America, but certainly it relates to the donors in Canada or anywhere, that they call the overhead myth. And I would encourage everybody on the call to go and look up the overhead myth through GuideStar or the BBBY's Giving Alliance or Charity Navigator, which were the three signatories to this. And they talk about the fact that there's a misconception, and they want to alert people to not use the overhead measure to decide which charities to support. And they actually encourage people or encourage organizations to incur more overhead in order to be more effective in their particular sphere. And really what they're talking about is what we talk about, and how can you show that you're having impact? That's really the conversation with the donor. And They provide some really great statistics on it. So again, I would encourage you to go and look that up. But really, there will be people always that won't be swayed, and as you say, bless and release. But you really have to ask people why they're supporting the organization to begin with. Is it because they want to have some impact in the community, or is it because they want to have all of their dollars go to a particular program? I mean, those are very different conversations. I think having impact conversation is really the way that you educate your donors.
Okay, I want to pick up on that a little bit more, because, you know, in some ways, you don't have programs without staff. You know, you don't have programs without a copy machine to produce some of the handouts or what have you. So have we done ourselves have we kind of set ourselves up for this a little bit? So is it our problem as well as our donors' problem? Is it not only their perceptions, but is it ours too?
Yes, it's Laura. It's absolutely on nonprofits to educate themselves about this and start to talk about it. Because if we do it as a sector and we speak, you know, as together as possible, then we're going to have a stronger voice. And many more people are going to be educated about this. One person that's been talking about this is Dan Pallotta. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he wrote a book called Charity Case. And he advocates that it's not how big, how much of a slice of the pie you're using for overhead. It's how you can grow the pie and have more impact. And so he's been speaking about this for a couple of years now, and we agree wholeheartedly with what he has to say. He has a wonderful TED Talk. And if you just Google Dan Pallotta, P-A-L-O-T-T-A, and you will find that he has a great deal to say on this subject.
Great. We'll be sure to put that in our follow-up. So that's Dan Pallotta and a TED Talk. We will visit that. Yes, I had actually the opportunity to speak with him at the Association of Healthcare Philanthropy. He's very dynamic and fun in person as well. So I'm sure his TED Talk is terrific. Now I want to shift to saying, as nonprofits, we're constantly asking for in-kind contributions of just about everything. So we'll look for contributions of space. We'll look for, you know, office supplies. We'll look for, support food at events. We're always looking for those kind of in-kind contributions to reduce what we're paying out, excuse me. And I think you alluded to this earlier, but how does this play into the overhead myth, the in-kind contributions?
It's or Laura.
Mm-hmm.
It does. It absolutely does, in that it sets us up to be viewed as begging all the time for a break, give us something for free, and it really doesn't take into consideration that the nonprofit sector contributes greatly to the economy. We're a major driver, and if we flipped it around and said, okay, you're a for-profit corporation, you should be begging for a break on your rent. You should be asking people to give you stuff for free so that you can carry on and sell your goods and services more effectively. I mean, that's a ridiculous conversation. So why should it apply to nonprofits?
Okay, so both of you in your work, in your firm, do events, do some event work. So how do we, what's a healthier way for us to look at gathering some of these things with events? Because I guess I have to, confess that as I put events together, there are things that our donors do in kind that's helpful for the event. So what's a healthier way to look at this? Or is there a fit?
Well, it's Julie. There are a couple of things. One, and this is probably another whole topic, but working with for-profits to talk about sponsorship of events that will help them meet their business goals. And rather than approaching them with a tin cup and saying, do you have anything you could give us, getting them more involved. It could be through employee engagement. It could be maybe they want to give everybody a chance to try a new product. Whatever their business goals are, working with them instead of approaching them to give you something for free. And a lot of companies that understand these concepts of sponsorship will actually be more generous. They will want to do their part to make sure their goals are met, but also because they agree with your mission. So that's part of it. And the other is, If you approached people as individuals and asked for their support as donors, it may be that you can take that event right off of your calendar. If you concentrate more on engaging people at that level, you may not ever have to do another event.
Woohoo! Bravo! I really appreciate you being so direct about that. Honestly, that's an even better question. How can you do more thoughtful fundraising so that you don't have to have the event at all? I mean, or the event takes on a different purpose, and that is to be information or educational instead of fundraising. Or thank
you. Well, it's about engaging donors.
Yes.
And not just sending them a letter once a year.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Do you feel that with the emphasis on businesses having more of a social conscience, that some of our old strategy for sponsorship about, you know, you're a blue one and you get this and this and this, and you're a red one and you get this and this, and you're a pink one, you know, do you think that's as important as it used to be, or are some of these other agendas starting to be just as important or more important in your experience?
It's Julie. In our experience, businesses actually get a little annoyed at being sent the package of gold, silver, and bronze. They get exasperated because they get so many requests. But the businesses who have figured out that sponsorship they have to put as much into it in terms of activity, not just dollars, as the charitable organization, those are the ones that are successful. And if the charities come forward and say, let's talk about what your business goals are and how we might be able to help you with that, at the same time raising either profile or funds for our organization. That's an entire discussion about sponsorship.
Yes, it is. So let's talk to you about what your business goals are and how working with us helps you accomplish those. A much better question than, well, what can I put you down for? Yeah, indeed.
Exactly.
Yeah. We've mentioned this before a little bit on, you know, you said before concentrating on overhead is a race to the bottom. That's a really powerful statement. Would you like to comment on that a little bit more, and especially if that's sort of how your board feels, though your board is passionate about this cost per dollar raise number? Are there some key messages that'll turn them around that we haven't addressed yet?
Yes, there are.
Okay.
And it's about educating the board, and it's about getting the board out into the work of your organization. So it's about showing the board the impact and getting them to understand that the less you invest, the harder it is to make impact. So it's about increasing that investment. Laura talked about the bigger pie for greater impact. The other thing to talk about the board with, or talk with about to the board, is there's always opportunity costs. So, for example, if the notion is that we have to cut as much as we can, if that means that we're not communicating with our donors, there's a huge opportunity cost there, because the donors will just say, I haven't heard from you, so I'm going to go somewhere else.
Excellent.
Or if the opportunity to take advantage of getting out and meeting potential major donors, because you don't have the budget for that, well, you can see the opportunity cost for that is huge, because if you aren't willing to go out and meet with them, well, why should they even be interested?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of conversation to have with the board.
You know, that is excellent. That is absolutely excellent, because on the one hand, they'll ask you for financial numbers, and they'll say, you know, which I always encourage us to do far more than just numbers to our boards anyway. Tell them the stories, tell them how we got the numbers or what leads to the numbers, but regardless, there's still numbers you share, and we get kind of lost in just saying, how do these numbers compare to last year's numbers or last month's or what have you, instead of what you're saying is really analyze why are those numbers what they are and how have they changed, and if in fact, like the one organization you talked about earlier where they raise $500,000 a year and have consistently, well, that would be a brilliant place to say, yes, we're not coming up because we can't. That's a real clear example of opportunity costs, where they don't have the funds to stay in touch with their donors, so they're really just siphoning through a new batch of them every year, which is the most expensive kind of fundraising to do.
This is Julie. You're absolutely right, Marcy.
That's just a great way to put it, opportunity costs. I love that. Shifting just a little bit now, I encourage, you know, my clients and folks to create vibrant options of giving that include specific pieces of the annual operations budget. Sometimes I feel like we have to have buildings or projects instead of really looking at what are the kinds of things that repeat every year in our annual operations budget that we really could look at differently and say, would somebody be interested in helping us out with this? Is this something that you've used, or do you have any tips on how to best accomplish this?
Well, it's Julie. It is an interesting way of educating donors as to what the costs are. So if they can see that by giving a certain amount that it, for example, will cover the rent, or it will cover, as you say, those recurring budget items every year, I think that's a good way to help people understand why the dollars are needed, as long as you keep tying it back into impact.
Right.
As you know, unrestricted gifts are sort of few and far between these days, since everybody wants to designate their gift to the nth degree. But it's also an opportunity to say to them, we can't have impact if we don't have, as you say, the photocopier, the telephones, or even a space to work out of. So, yeah, I think it's a great way to educate people.
And also to look at your programs. And one of my favorite examples is if you consider a continuous care facility, and you know, the whole healthcare picture and our aging populations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have lots of them. And just things like every month you'll have entertainment for your seniors. You might have art projects. Those are all things that enrich the experience of the seniors who reside in your facilities. And I could see those as being delightful things for people to invest in that are just kind of line items on your budget, you know, a budget each month to have supplies like that, a budget each month to bring in a singer or what have you. Those are the kinds of things I'm thinking about.
Yes, it's Julie. Yeah, I think that is good because people seem to want to tie their gifts into something that they can see or hear about or visualize, and that is a good way of going about it.
Yeah, and I suppose the pushback to that, and again, as it relates to our conversation, is the more specificity you have, you do need somebody to keep track of it, you know, and make sure you say the art supplies are provided by Marcy Himes Gift or whatever, and that, again, if you're pinching that staff to the, you know, if you're tightening your belt, and your staff is kind of overwhelmed with the amount of tasks that fall under their position, that kind of specificity is hard to keep track of, you know, to manage. So I suppose that would be, again, another point of saying, you know, let's try to expand the pie. Let's look at different ways to bring dollars in and look at having a staff that can grow those specific pieces of engagement. So I'm curious, we're all out there doing these jobs, and we're talking about our different kind of work with donors, and you've had years of experience, both of you have, and you do such a wonderful job with the folks that you work with, and I think we always look to people like you to say, share with us what you think are the mistakes that you see as you work with different clients and different folks. I'm stepping away a bit from our topic, but what do you see are some of our common mistakes, and what can we do to correct them?
It's Laura. There are a few themes that run through our work with the clients, and one of the main ones is that it's not about you. It's about the donor. So it's not about you throwing a bunch of statistics out about how wonderful you are, how many clients you serve, and blah, blah, blah. It's about how can you make the donor feel like they're a hero. And our clients, when they see the light bulb go on and they start to talk about it in a different way, then they see that donors start to respond to that. So, for example, if you're, instead of saying, this is what we did last year, thank you for your donation, you say, because of you, somebody was, and you be very specific, you have a story about somebody who was served and was improved and there was impact because of the donor. That's a very different conversation with the donor than thank you for your donation.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Very much so. And kind of on this theme too, we do hear a lot about being overwhelmed, you know, that there's just not enough time to do everything. How does the overhead myth contribute to this or impact this?
It's Laura. Yes, it definitely contributes to it it makes people think, again, that they have to go out begging all the time, and it creates a lot of busy work. So if you're out there begging for in-kind donations and prizes for your auction and things like that, that shouldn't be your priority. Your priority should be engaging your donors. And how do you do that? You get out and you visit them. And so rather than focusing on scarcity, focusing on abundance and solving problems and being successful is a different mentality. And so then you're going to be able to prioritize your time. So you'll say, instead of spending half a day driving around town and picking up prizes for the silent auction, for the event that we're eventually going to get rid of, that if you're going to say, I'm going to go to this part of the state or the city and I'm going to visit with three major donors and ask them their advice and engage them and show them what we're doing because of them, those are very different activities and very different return on investment.
Indeed, and you said two of my favorite words, scarcity and abundance. This whole feeling of lack sometimes, and I'm wondering, I'm going to get a little philosophical on you, but, you know, some of our nonprofits, of course, are in education and some of these things, but a lot of our nonprofits work with folks who are struggling. They've got debilitating diseases, or they have financial issues, or they have, you know, violence and these kinds of things that really resonate out of out of this lack mindset. And I wonder sometimes if our work in some of these areas kind of shifts into us. We sort of absorb some of that. And do you have any advice or things that you do when you feel yourself taking on kind of a, oh, poor me, or gee, this is hard, or a lack attitude? How do you shift yourself back into that abundance viewpoint?
It's Julie. I think part of it is related to the poverty mentality that that nonprofits have, and it's the prevailing thought has always been, well, to serve our community, we have to make sure we're not spending much money on ourselves. And that just takes you further and further into the pit of despair. What we should be saying to the community, to ourselves, is how can we bring the best of ourselves to the problem at hand? And that includes having people make a living wage, and in fact not just a living wage, but one that allows them to flourish, so that when they arrive at work to to solve problems. They're not scraping by at home trying to solve their own problems. They're actually coming with some renewed energy to say, okay, what can we do and how can we best do it?
Yes, that's wonderful. That's very inspiring. I was trying to write all that down. I love that. You know, it is this whole idea of just getting by or, you know, just barely. I love the idea of saying not just a living wage, but how do we make them flourish? And I think for our nonprofits, this also kind of comes into vision. And again, I'm taking us a bit away, but how does if we look at it, and I'm sure you've worked a lot with your clients on establishing their long-range vision or doing some kind of strategic planning, and how can we have that strategic plan help us get out of this overhead myth and bring things into better balance?
It's Julie. Part of it is getting organizations to collaborate more with other people in the community. There's been a sense that you have to start up your own organization or continue your own organization no matter what. And so you make your plans based on that premise. But we've seen collaborations in cities in Canada that can be very powerful and bring resources together without having organizations absorb other organizations. They just decide that the problem requires all of their presence. There's a whole housing strategy in Calgary, Alberta, for example, where I think they've got at least 9 organizations coming together on a huge fundraising campaign that is not diminishing the organizations at all. In fact, it's raising them up. So I think that's the direction that people need to go in, is saying, okay, we see this in the community. How can we, are there others who are seeing it as well, and how can we work together?
Yep. And, you know, in terms of strategic planning, I think how I hear that manifesting itself is instead of in strategic planning, you know, sometimes people use strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And I don't know how many times I've been in conversations where another organization is viewed as a threat. They're doing the same thing. How do we do something better than they do or differently or uniquely? Instead of saying, are there pieces of our organization that could collaborate and do this together? So it really begins at that whole visioning process where when you look 10 years out, if your statement is to say, how can we collaborate more? If that's a question you ask as part of your plan, that's a very different question than we've sometimes asked in the past. Do you think?
I totally agree. It's Julie, and I've seen it in many organizations that's not even a question that people pose to themselves. As you say, they see other organizations' competition it does a disservice to everyone.
Well, and would you think that our donors, our individuals, foundations, and corporations, I think across the board, are looking or starting to ask different questions of us, where they're starting to say, I've been approached by organization X, and it sounds to me like you do some things that are similar. Have you thought about working together? Do you think that's a question that we hear more now and will continue to hear more?
It's Julie. It is a question that is starting to be asked, especially as governments pull back from funding in Canada. I'm not sure to what extent it is in the U.S.
Okay, same here.
But, for example, the Winnipeg Foundation here gets requests from just about everybody in the community, and they have been starting to ask, well, what else is going on here? Are there other organizations that you could collaborate with or even do things like share space or share services like HR or accounting, that sort of thing? It's definitely starting to become part of the conversation.
What what do you think is the underlying fear behind not collaborating? What is the resistance?
It's Julie. There's always territoriality. People they're corner of the world, and they don't necessarily want to change it. So it's going to take some gutsy leadership in the community to say, okay, this really isn't working anymore. Let's try something else. But for a lot of people, they don't want to change. And even though it appears it's not working, like that organization that doesn't spend much on raising money, if they don't change their attitude, that's never going to change.
Yep, and that brings us nicely right back into our topic, because I do think that probably one of our biggest obstacles is this cost per dollar raise business. We've always done it this way. It's been a measure that's been put out there. It's been a measure that we've kind of, for better or worse, decided it will be judged upon. And so what you just said is so spot on. It's time to not only not shy away from the question, but to kind of introduce the topic, to bring it up and to say, we want you to know this is something we think needs to be viewed differently. Any thoughts there?
Well, it is going to take all of us talking about it. If people in development don't talk about that with their executive director, or they don't talk about it with their board or other staff or donors, then it will perpetuate. But the cat's out of the bag. We are talking about it, but people have to be committed to keeping the conversation going.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the amazing AFP Philanthropy Day that you do in your area. It is just an incredible event. It does everything right. And you know, not only does it honor folks, but it was an incredible continuous learning experience. You have a workshop in connection with it. Talk a little bit for me. And now I want to just kind of say, in general, kind of with the fundraisers on this call, talk to me a little bit about continuous learning and how do fundraisers balance wanting to be involved with AFP and taking courses and yet really keeping that focus on having those conversations that, get their major gift calls done. In your opinion, what should fundraisers consider? When should fundraisers consider going for the CFRE or an advanced degree? Or just give me your sense of how we should manage our continuing education as a percentage of time or as part of our overall work?
It's Laura. It's because fundraising is now viewed as a profession, there is an expectation, even if people don't really see it that way, of lifelong learning. If you're not learning on a continual basis, then you're falling behind, because there's continually new things to learn about fundraising and how people do things. And it's also about getting out of your office, being part of that fundraising community in your own community, and making sure that you're making connections that you can go and network with. You may meet somebody that's doing something similar, and you may be able to say to somebody, can I give you a call, have a coffee, and talk about how you're doing that? Sounds like it's very similar to us, and maybe I can pick your brain. That's one aspect of it. The other thing is, if someone wants to go for a CFRE or an ACFRE, it's fantastic if that's how they want to focus their learning. Some people in our community, they didn't have a chance to go on to college or university, and they like the structure of the CFRE program. So they see it more as something that they can hang their professional development around. So that we'd absolutely encourage that. It's not really about the credentials, though. It's about how you're keeping up with what's going on in your profession.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yes. Well, I have one final question for you, and that is, you both have had tremendous long-time experience, and you're such incredible development professionals. As you look back on what you've accomplished already and then kind of look ahead, if you could give one piece of advice or your legacy of advice for all of our folks on the call, what would this be?
It's Laura. My advice is to get out of the office and meet your donors. Don't hide behind research. Don't hide behind your computer. Don't hide behind your phone. Get out and meet them face to face. It's Julie. I would advise you to be genuine. Always act with integrity. Represent yourself well, and you'll represent your organization well.
Excellent advice. Thank you. So now tell us, before we have to close here, tell us a little bit about the best way for folks to get in touch with you. Would you be open to getting emails, and just how to get in touch with you? What would be the best way?
Certainly email is how to get in touch. We also have a blog that we write and a newsletter that people can sign up for. And you can do all of that through our website at mikuska.com, M-I-K-U-S-K-A.com, and we'd love to hear from folks.
Well, that is tremendous. All right, mikuska.com, and I subscribe to their newsletter, and I love reading their comments. And Julie and Laura, thank you so much for spending time with us today on this very important topic of overhead. It's an important conversation, and you've given us some great, great advice today on how to talk with our board, how to talk with our donors, and how to get around ourselves and just realize that we're worth being invested in and to continue our education. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
It's been our pleasure.
And to all of you, thanks so much for being on our call today. I want to remind you, coming up in July, on July 7th, will be our email coaching day, which is the day that you can send in your email questions to me, and I will do my very best to respond to you in 24 hours. Really important, be sure you put Major Gift Success Club or MGSC question in the subject line so that I can sort that out and be sure to see your question and get to it, and just send that simply to marcy@marcyheim.com. And on the 21st of July will be our next topic call. As always, all our calls are recorded, and you can find them on your website, on the website, and also I'll email an audio out to you. So I'd like to close today by reminding you to invest in joy, and that joy in your life that comes from doing this honorable and noble profession, and know that you make a difference in this world. And I thank you for the difference that you make. So Laura and Julie, thank you once again. To all of you, thank you. Have a tremendous day. Invest in joy. This is Marcy Heim saying bye-bye now.